made some tough mistakes, I think, during that period. Really important lesson for entrepreneurship is like money doesn't solve your problems. You know, I think we raised probably, I think when I first started as an entrepreneur, I was like, hey, if I can just raise that big round, success will be there. And learned that that's not true. In fact, too much money can cause its own problems. It causes you to kind of be a little lazy and try to cut corners and hire people to solve problems. And I've just learned, and we've just learned time and time again, that like the founders have to at least come up with a solid V1 on most things. It's really hard to sort of outsource that.
Did you clear your cash flow?
My guest on the pod today is Jeff Whitlock, CEO of Grain. So I think this might be the first guest I've had on the pod whose product I use every single day, literally. So I'm really excited about that, to dive into the products, you know, hear about maybe some of the roadmap stuff you got, and also just kind of hear about the company and, you know, history of the company and Jeff's journey as an entrepreneur. So, you know, just kind of kick it off. Welcome, Jeff, to the pod.
Thanks. Really happy to be here.
Yeah. So I have to say, I was just saying in the intro, I use Grain literally every day. I used to take meeting notes. I no longer take meeting notes. I just solely rely on the notes that Grain provides me, like the full AI summary, and literally just like, you know, I'll have a meeting, copy and paste that into Slack or like a CRM or something. And it's amazing feature. You guys really knocked it out of the park with that one.
It's awesome. Love hearing that. Super cool. Now we just need to get you to automate that part of getting it to Slack and the CRMs. Maybe I can help you with that after the.
Oh, podcast. Yeah. You got like a Zapier or something for that?
No, well, we got integrations. So.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, definitely. Let's dig into all that when we get into the product. So I think you aren't always the CEO of Grain. I think you joined through like a merger or I think some kind of acquisition or something in the early days.
Yeah. A few years ago, I was working on a startup that did asynchronous video chatting. So it was kind of like, if you know the Slack clips feature, this was before that feature existed. It was just like a way for people in a work context to like record your screen or record yourself and just send messages back and forth as a chat app.
Okay, cool. So I'm sorry, Gil, were you gonna say something?
Oh, I was just gonna kind of say it didn't really like, we got a lot of great traction in the early days of the pandemic, but as the pandemic kind of went on and everyone's like, the new normal is remote work, then a lot of the existing, you know, platforms like Slack and stuff started building a lot of our feature set into their platforms and just ultimately saw that there wasn't going to be a way to break in the market. So when that happened, that's when we knew Mike and Jake, the founders of Grain, and thought, hey, you know, let's try to, we're both in this kind of similar video tech space and we have similar capabilities. And so better, you know, join forces and try to build a better company together.
Yeah, cool. Did those features get like merged into the Grain product, or how did that, like, what did that look like?
Initially, there was some intent to do more of that. It didn't, not much of it happened. We learned, like all startups learn, and we kind of changed course a little bit and sort of became a little bit less relevant. Initially, it was like, yeah, we can actually utilize some of these features, but at the end of it didn't end up really going that direction.
Okay. So I feel like, I mean, I've been using Grain, it has to be 3 or 4 years at this point. So I guess I was probably like an early customer then, huh?
Yeah, you were probably an early customer. Yep.
Nice. So take me through like the history of the company. Like how was the company ideated? Like what was the thesis behind the company originally? And just sort of like what was the, you know, what was kind of like the founding story there?
Yeah. So I think, with the caveat that I wasn't here for the first few chapters of the story, Mike and Jake Adams are brothers. Mike had previously, the former CEO and founder, you know, still actually a member of the company, or really great member of the company. He had actually done a startup that was sold to WeWork previously about, it was called Mission U, which was a company that essentially did education. It was for folks kind of like as like a technical, like remote technical school that when WeWork did like the WeGrow, they bought them to kind of help some of their tech to kind of do the whole like WeGrow thing, if you know that story. But anyway,
I think, but I've actually heard of that acquisition. I don't know if it was big news or not, but it sounds really familiar to me.
Yeah, it was mentioned, I think, in the show We Crashed, the Apple.
That's probably where I heard it from then. Yeah, yeah. I should have seen that.
So, yeah, we had a fun, we thought that was fun. We joked to Mike, you're famous, you know, your old startup was mentioned in this show. But anyway, so, but in his experience, he kind of realized we're doing a lot of these remote learning sessions and the experience around recording them is not very good. And so that was kind of the initial gist of the idea. So it started. Grain started off just very much as this idea that all these meetings are going to be moving on to from kind of analog conversations, digital conversations, and there's a lot of value in these meetings. We should make it a lot easier for them to be, you know, a lot easier to record and make them accessible and useful.
So I don't know like how deep you can get into the tech, but what fascinates me about Grain is like, you know, what you're talking about here, like the state that it's in now is this whole like AI summary of the meeting. And, you know, I've seen other tools before, like there's a few of them out there that are, you know, I guess direct competitors of you guys, and they take forever to create the transcript where like I get off a Grain call and I have the transcript in like 5 seconds. So I don't know if you guys are like, are you building your own language models, or like how do you get it that fast?
No, we use partners for transcription. We do some stuff on some processing on our end, but it's mostly just kind of how we our strategy and pipeline and how we sort of send the text the audio data in real time while the meeting's happening, basically. So that's sort of being processed in simultaneous as your meeting's happening, so that when your meeting is done, it's all ready for you.
Like wrapped up and ready to go. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So back to the story. So, you know, you kind of merged forces with the original founders. What was it like? I mean, you guys were, I think you were raising during like the peak Zerp era. So that was a wild time to be a startup. I'm sure there was like some roller coaster moments through all that. What was like, you know, just take me through like the history of the company and the trajectory and just kind of like, you know, any, you know, fun or crazy stories along the way.
Yeah. So I think, couple more. So we basically, I'd say, so Grain raised a Series A from Tiger Global, 2021, kind of very much like peak Zerp, like we talked about. I had just come out of YC with my startup, raised the money, raised around, and a few months after that, realized, hey, this thesis probably isn't going to work out. And so that's when we decided to merge. So a couple of interesting things around that is we Tiger was the investor. So just what I tell people about Grain, it's interesting is that like, we still have control of the company because Tiger invested. Tiger has since become a re-engaged partner, but there was kind of a time where they were figuring their stuff out and where it was just sort of, you know, a lot of people when they raise a Series A, they bring on a board seat, they have a lot of close like oversight, but for us, we were, you know, just given a lot of money and some like, you know, just go figure it out. And so, you know, we made some tough mistakes, I think, during that period. Really important lesson for entrepreneurship is like money doesn't solve your problems. You know, I think I think when I first started as an entrepreneur, I was like, hey, if I can just raise that big round, success will be there. And learned that that's not true. In fact, too much money can cause its own problems. It causes you to kind of be a little lazy and try to cut corners and hire people to solve problems. And I've just learned, and we've just learned time and time again that like the founders have to at least come up with a solid V1 on most things. It's really hard to sort of outsource that. Even if you hire really talented people, you kind of are like a good analogy is like, you know, you're building the foundation. And if the foundation isn't there, it's very unlikely for another person to come in and build a foundation and attach it to your foundation in like a very coherent way. So. Yeah, I think that's kind of like some broad brushstrokes of the story. But since then we've learned some of those tough lessons of overscaling and we've kind of right sided the ship. And now, you know, I think we're trying to grow into those peak valuations, but things are going really well. We're growing pretty fast. I'd say one other interesting piece of the story is pre-AI. So when did ChatGPT came out, like March of 2023 or something like that?
I think it was early. It was like mid 2022.
November. I think it was late 2022.
Yeah, anyway, I think you're right.
So late 2022, it comes out, and were like, oh my gosh, this is game changing. And so we were one of the first people to launch AI notes, but then it was like not a secret. Everyone realized, because we had already, in the early days of sort of call it V1 of recording, it's like we had already had a few competitors and a lot of them had actually kind of died. And V1 of recording is like record the meeting, transcribe, easy to find and search. That's like V1. And then there was still a few out there, you know, like Otter, Fireflies, a few of that kind of first era ones that were around. And then with AI, there's a whole new batch. And some of them are doing great things. So I don't want to be disparaging to them, but it's just been really interesting just to see kind of like with this new tech, just how many people kind of jump in the obvious application of it. And so we've had just a huge number of new competitors join in that are kind of more like 2 to 3 year old companies, whereas like the original ones are like 4 to 5 year old companies. So it's been interesting to try to compete with them. And they often have like new, fresh blood, fresh capital, and we're still kind of going on. And that's been a really interesting to kind of think about the strategic and market dynamics of our industry, and one with like obvious value, but not great moats. And so that's been really interesting, and not necessarily enough network effects for like there to be obvious winner take all quickly.
Yeah. So you just said so much in there. I want to unpack a few things, but I'll start with one of the last things you said. Do you think it helps that you guys have, you know, you had the V1, like the pre AI product, and you have a flywheel and like customer success and sales teams, and you've got like your ads figured out and that kind of stuff. Like, does it help that you have that flywheel of a business already in place? Or do you think like these newer companies that are just sort of building now, like, do they have an advantage that they're starting with like a fresh slate, or what are your thoughts around that?
I think we definitely have an advantage. Like we have, you know, a lot of things like domain authority. There's a few topical authorities we have. So our SEO wheel is going really well. And we've hit a lot of the icebergs already along the way. And so I think there's a lot of advantages to our experience and why I ultimately think we're going to survive a lot of this new wave. I mean, there'll be a couple, I think, that come out, because I just don't think our industry has like a true kind of winner take all mechanics, like fundamentally. But that being said, there are also downsides to kind of, you kind of have this big product that you, and a lot of users that you kind of have to keep around, or maybe you don't. And then you make a lot of them mad. We recently, you made this point about how Grain is immediately, like as soon as it's done, the transcripts there. One of the features that we had built very early on was this feature where like you actually can open the meeting in real time live and see the transcript like in perfect real time. And we ultimately deprecated that feature. We're bringing back a version of it, and I don't know if that's 100% the right call. We're just kind of listening to our old customers and who kind of miss it. But we deprecated that because it was costing us a ton of money, and it wasn't being used by the vast majority of our new customers. It was just like a handful of old customers, and that was a tough call. A lot of internal decision making and sort of, you know, navel gazing about it. And whereas, like, I think if you're a brand new startup, you can kind of look at all the precedences and make really informed decisions and move faster in some ways. So there's definitely advantages to both. Now, this is again talking about, I learned the flip side of this by my previous startup where I was like trying to compete with Slack, which is like Slack had a lot of product issues and a lot of mistakes. And I think, and I still think to this day, it's not a great product. I think it's gotten worse since the acquisition with Salesforce, but they have immense network effects. It's a multiplayer product with incredible lock-in and network effects. And it's just so hard to, it's very much the market is very much like a lock-in winner take all or a couple winners take all market. And so it's been interesting to see like the different kind of dynamics of markets and how it creates a different competitive landscapes.
Yeah, they have Slack's an interesting company. I recently read I forget the founder's name, but they Stuart put Butterfield. Out what's that?
Stuart Butterfield?
Yes, Stuart. Stuart put out a letter when in the very early days of Slack. I don't know if it was like the founding letter or if it came shortly thereafter, but it was basically, it probably was a little after, because I think it was more of an internal memo to the team, just about like how to think about products, how to think about, you know, customer experience, how to think about, you know, innovating. And, you know, sure, as you said, like, especially with this recent Slack release they did maybe 6 months ago, I think the product has gone downhill a little bit. But reading the letter, I feel like is somewhat of a masterclass in just how to write, like how to share, like as a founder, how to share your vision in a way that's impactful. It's a really great letter if you've ever checked that out.
Yeah, I love it. That's awesome.
So cool. So I want to touch on Tiger for a second, because that was an interesting story. That was like one of the poster child, you know, I think all that, what was it, all the hedgy stuff back in the day with, or, you know, a couple of years ago with like the Wall Street bets and all these, you know, GameStop stock and all the short, you know, I think Tiger was mixed up in all that. I don't know exactly, you know, if they were in the short selling business, but they were like the big, I think when things were kind of going downhill in 2022, they were kind of like one of the big, you know, New York funds that was, you know, I think it was them and SoftBank were kind of like labeled as the, you know, the over, you know, kind of like pumping too much money into startups and, you know, hype valuations and all this stuff. What's been your experience like after they, you know, kind of like went belly up? What was your experience with like dealing with them? Did they just completely go MIA, or are they, you said they're like, I guess the, you know, the, what do you call it? Like a trust or whoever took over the entities, are they kind of getting back involved with you guys at this point, or what's been your experience there?
Yeah. I don't want to beat up on them. They're still a partner for ours. Obviously they're invested in us, and we want to do right by them. And I think if they were here having this conversation, they would probably, you know, they would probably have a lot of interesting lessons to share. I think they made a bet that was an interesting bet at the time about like, hey, you know, I don't want to misstate it, but their thesis. And again, there was like the hedge fund of Tiger Global, and then there was like the Tiger Global Ventures arm. And we worked with the venture arm, obviously. And their bet was like, hey, you know, the entrepreneurs don't want a bunch of these value added services that VCs are saying they bring, and they don't really actually add that much value. What really matters is fast, quick capital. That's what entrepreneurs want. And so if we give like a really simple investment experience and give, you know, companies enough money to win their space, then we can kind of play kingmaker and we can deploy the capital efficiently and get some of the best deals. I think it was in some ways, you know, in hindsight, obviously we see the mistakes, and we see the, you know, where that thesis was wrong. The time, I think it was reasonable. It was an interesting bold bet, and I don't ever want to like beat up on people for taking a bold bet. That being said, and I think as maybe as time goes on, that bet will look less dumb. Like I think they might have some winners in their portfolio. You never know. That's the crazy thing about VC and power law games, is it just takes a while to see the full story. You know, who knows? Not saying Grain's going to do it, but like, you know, if Grain becomes like a multi-billion-dollar company, it's like, you know, make their portfolio look a lot better. Anyway, that being said, there are a lot of strange things about the experience, you know, just having gone through it. Just like I said, it's like very uncommon for a post series A company to, you know, to maintain control and have the board as we do. And that's awesome. I'm grateful now that that's the case, because you know, we were able to sort of like go slower and regroup. And now I think we're in a really strong position as a company. Whereas like maybe if that wasn't the case, we might've had more pressure to kind of like just keep pushing hard and until we ran out of money. But now I think we're in a good place where we're building a healthy business that's going to get profitable, and then we'll be in a position to take on more capital and try to win. It was also odd just kind of like when the partners left, just kind of not knowing who to talk to, and just the whole thing was kind of weird. Like I didn't know exactly where to set board updates to. But you know, like I said, they've since kind of gotten back together and reorganized, and funny enough, even before, you know, I talked to set up this podcast, we've been back in touch with them, and they've got a great partner that we're really excited to start working with. So that's why I said they're regrouping a little bit.
Nice. That's good. Yeah. And it was interesting. I felt like in that 2022 time span, it went like the year started off where, you know, it was exactly what you said, like spend, grow, you know, scale. And then it was just, there was like a week where everything just flipped, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, lay off, like extend runway, slow your burn. You know, it's like everything just flipped, and just, it felt like a coin, you know, just like the flip of a coin, you know, just like a moment's notice, everything just kind of like just changed all at once.
Yeah.
It was a wild time.
Another wild experience, because you said crazy story. Another wild experience is we were banking with SVB. We had a lot of that Tiger money in SVB, and we had got early win from some of our other investors about the potential to like, you know, riskiness of the bank. But,
real quick on that. You said you got an early warning.
Yeah, we were on some of the early like email lists of like, hey, you know, to check out Tiger. They might be in a vulnerable position. And
you're saying SVB or Tiger?
Sorry, SVB. I'm misspeaking. SVB. Yeah. So other investors told us about SVB having, you know, potential issues with their capitalization. And so like we had a, as a team, we're like, hey, do we want to try to move? But we really liked the SVB team, and we had a venture debt note with them, and we, and the, like, if we were to pull money, that would break our covenants. And so for a variety of decisions, call them some values decision. Like I just, I, what's funny is I literally just the couple weeks before this whole event, I just finished a book called Monetary Policy in the 21st Century by Ben Bernanke. Great book, by the way. Former Fed chair. He just writes a book where he kind of tells the story of the Fed. And he has a whole chapter on bank runs and why they happen, the psychology of them. And so I just finished that book and I was like, this is going to be a bank run. And I just, like, on a values perspective, I kind of believed it was such a valuable institution that it would be backstopped and that I didn't want to be a participant. And now maybe that's, now if they had, in hindsight, it's like, oh, I took the, you know, I took the honorable position and it was fine because the feds and the treasury stepped in. It, you know, if that hadn't happened, I would have looked like an idiot. So that's why bank runs are really, really tricky. I think the game theory and the psychology of them are super, super complicated and tricky. But nonetheless, we decided not to pull our money. We kept it in there. And but then once it was like, hey, the bank run's actually happening, we did try to move a little bit out, but like enough where we didn't feel like it violated our covenants, just we had some to keep operating the company. But like there was a weekend where we were like, we put that in, I think, so late that we wasn't even sure we would get that out. And so it was like, dang, we had like a little bit of extra in like another bank. But like we were like, frick, we're not gonna be able to keep running this business. And so that was a very, very stressful weekend. I remember, I think it was right before the Oscars.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Right before the Oscars, Janet Yellen and Powell, Jerome Powell kind of announced, hey, we're going to, here's the plan. We're going to save it. All the depositors will be whole. And we're like, I can just remember like, those were like most enjoyable Oscars of my life. I just relaxed. Like, oh, all will be well. And then of course, in the startup journey the next week, there's more problems and you're stressed out again. So.
I was down in Costa Rica when it was all going down with a friend of mine who's an executive at TD.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm unplugging. I'm not going to check news or like check my emails. And then I saw the SVB thing and I told him about it. He's like, holy shit, what? And then he's like on his phone the whole time.
Oh man, tough time to try to unplug.
But yeah, that was nuts. So how early did you get the warning? I mean, I heard there was like circulating emails from VCs maybe like 2 or 3 days early.
Yeah, it was just like that. I think we were just on some of those group chains. It wasn't like we had a super, super early insight. And To be honest, I even like missed one of them in my inbox. It was one of the other co-founders that saw it and was like, hey, we might want to look at this.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that was a crazy, that all went down so fast. But anyway, let's move on here. So I'm curious, like after everything you've described, you know, the kind of experience with Tiger, like the hands-off thesis for investing, definitely not normal. I think, you know, most VCs tend to get, you know, relatively opinionated on, you know, how to run the business and, you know, making decisions and stuff like that. Would you raise VC again if you were doing another company in the future? And would you rather have a more hands-on VC or do you prefer the more hands-off approach of Tiger?
Yeah, I mean, great questions. I think the first one is hard to answer categorically. I would say it depends. And I would be much more, I'd say, cautious in taking VC money. I think when I started my entrepreneurial journey, I just like, this is the way you do it. You know, get an idea, you get a little bit of early traction, you sweat equity, and then once you can raise money, you should raise money because then you can pay yourself and grow and blah, blah. I think there was like a very much like, this is the path. And I didn't consider many other paths. I would say if I were to do it again, obviously, I think I'm this time around, I'd be in a position where I would have a little bit more starting capital and stuff, and maybe in people who would maybe invest, but just as like, you know, friends, family, angels, which I didn't have the first time around. So given that though, I would only take the money if I felt like I was in a market where I needed it to play and win. And I could talk to you about what I think constitutes that kind of market. But if there was a path where I could grow steadily without a worry of other competitors sort of, you know, making the opportunity go away, I would probably try to march along the bootstrap path, you know, as long as possible. Own your business, have control. It makes the big thing, in my opinion, it's not even about control. It's just about the optionality on like what to do if you create something valuable. It's like right now with Grain, for example, like we built a valuable company. You know, we have millions of dollars of annual recurring revenue. We've got a product people love, but even that, like if, for example, like tomorrow I got really sick and I'm like, I couldn't keep pushing this business forward. So hopefully maybe someone else could take control, but it's like, and I had a buyer. It's like the odds of like me getting a buyer that like can clear my pref stack and, you know, get me and me and the other key people who have spent their life on this business, like a return that we're all super just jazzed about, is hard. It's hard. You know, you really have to find that kind of like breakout growth and value before you're kind of in the black, so to speak, on your return in a way that everyone who works so hard to get there is really, you know, happy. Whereas if you have full control, you and maybe a few partners have full control and you find a $10-15 million exit, you now, that's like crazy. That's great money for everyone. You know what I mean? So that's the main thing, is I think it just kind of takes away your exit options a little bit. The more money you raise, that's the main thing I'd be thoughtful about.
I want to take a quick break from the episode and say, if you're enjoying this content, the best way you can say thank you is to subscribe. So if you're on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. And if you're on one of the podcast platforms, hit the subscribe button there as well. And also share it out to your friends and colleagues. If you find this content useful and you think other people will enjoy it as well, please send it out. And back to the episode. You really touched on this. I wanted to circle back to it. The concept of the founders, the people who have the vision for the product, really need to be super hands-on in the V1, both from, you know, software architecture decisions to user experience and, you know, customer experience and go-to-market strategies and how to, you know, build, you know, get the flywheel going, like the SEO flywheel you talked about, you know, if it's paid ads, whatever the kind of flywheels of the business are, and sort of like the secret sauce of what makes the product the product. That's so important. And I think the more money you raise, the faster you might be, you know, you said it earlier, like the faster you hire people, the more you try to like push off and delegate things. And, you know, maybe in those early days, maybe like having more like kind of maniacal control of the product and the business as a founder, maybe that like does help make the business more efficient, especially if you don't have the money to spend on people and growth. Like if you really have to like truly bootstrap it, there might be some value there.
I think what's interesting, this is my like armchair sort of prognostication, is you have books like Blitzscaling. I don't know if you read that book.
Or I haven't read that one.
Reid Hoffman. Anyway, you have a lot of like Silicon Valley narrative that's like, you know, once you unlock this mythical product market fit, it'll just, you know, take off. And now it's about just like scaling as fast as possible and just get people to kind of like essentially like, you know, stop this fire that you've created, like channel this fire you've created, you know, stop from burning everything else down. Like, I'm sure there's businesses like, I think a lot of those narratives got endless like this sort of like advice and sort of the milieu of just what to do as a founder sort of comes from some of these like very, very atypical, extremely successful top end of the power law businesses that were very viral by nature. Like they just, once they did have product market, like Facebook, for example, once they did have product market fit, like it just was such a viral product that it blew up. And like, it was basically, once Facebook was Facebook, there was very little you could have done to mess it up at some, you know, at one point. It was the right place, right time, incredibly viral. You could say similar things about LinkedIn. I'm not undermining the work that, you know, was done along the way, but that's a very different type of business than one where, you know, it's, you've got product market fit, you've got a market, people like the product, but it's not so viral. You have to build growth channels, or maybe even multiple growth channels, or you know, in synergistic loops, or like, you know, like I think there's more complicated businesses out there that need to be built. And I think a lot of people like are maybe take this thing like, oh, like every business is going to be on the trajectory of the LinkedIns and the Facebooks of the world. In reality, there's a lot of great businesses that are not on those trajectories. And so for those other kind of businesses where you need to figure out strategy, figure out how to get a moat, figure out maybe multiple different ways to grow, I think that's where it's like, you just need to be really careful to not get ahead of yourself in hiring and have people like, hey, you know, go figure out this part of the business when it's a core piece of the business model. You know, like I said, if your core piece of your business model is, you know, runaway viral growth, and no matter what's going to do, you're going to get it. And then you just need to figure out how to monetize it. Like that's, I don't know. I see them as being different. And I think that's where people get into trouble, where it's like, I've got product market fit. Okay, now I'm going to hire someone to do everything else. And when in reality, like if you, for a B2B SaaS business, like sometimes your service model and your customer success model is a core piece to your growth engine, because expansions are key, and you got to make sure that's compounding. And so it's, if you outsource customer success too early and tell someone just to build out the function without their understanding how all the pieces fit in together to create like the engine, that's where I think you get into trouble.
Yeah, and I think also some of those books you're talking about and some of those companies, like they were all, you know, the first batch of internet companies, you know, like the early 2000s, you know, I think the SaaS industry is much different 20 years later. Like in 2002 or 2001, you could, you know, build a CRM and be, you know, like a novel thing. Like you're the first, you know, Salesforce comes out. They're like the first, you know, cloud-based CRM that you can access in your browser back then. But nowadays you've got, you know, a million and one of those. So I feel like, you know, and back then, like moat was technology. You know, if you could build it, that was like a moat because you didn't have AWS and you had direct servers and you didn't have like all these, you know, high-end frameworks like Laravel and ExpressJS and React and all these things. So you had to like actually write a lot of code back then. So like technology was the moat. Whereas now, I think like distribution is like the way to build a moat now. Like if you have an unfair distribution channel, like if you have like an influencer or you have some way to reach customers that's, you know, not like the standard ways, then I think that's more the moat nowadays in SaaS at least. But there's like, you know, you look at companies like Figure, they make those humanoid robots, and you've got, you know, like the Tesla Prime or Primus or whatever it is, Optimus Prime or whatever they call it. Like those companies, I think, are like pioneering new frontiers. But they're like the next wave of like high tech. Whereas like SaaS, I think, was like new and novel in the early 2000s.
Yeah, no, well said. I think those are great points for sure.
But yeah, I mean, OpenAI definitely, they were like the 10-year overnight success for sure. You know, barely anybody heard of them until 2022. So they definitely kind of like, they proved there's still opportunity in you know, in SaaS and tech platform development.
Yeah, but even then, I would say OpenAI was doing something novel, right? It's like, or I guess I'd say they were doing a novel tech play where, you know, they knew that they were working on a frontier of tech, whereas like a lot of SaaS businesses are not. It's a product play. It's a product plus distribution, you know, plus model, maybe unique market. And so that's what a lot of SaaS is. And so I think just recognizing that that's the case. And I think when that's the case, I think sometimes people say, hey, this is SaaS, you know, you can outsource it. People have figured this out a lot of time. But I think, like I said, I think like a lot of SaaS businesses, there's got to be a lot of coherency between your product market, but also your model and your channel and your service model. And it's got to all be very tight and like, and work sense and be coherent. And so that's what we've learned is just like the coherency between like your strategy, your market, your model, your channel, and trying to outsource one of those early is where we got in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. Have you been following the 37 Signal guys with, they have this like once.com thing coming out. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it. No.
What are their names? I think it's Dan something and, totally blanking. I'm bad with names, but, Jason. Yeah. Yeah. Jason. And, what's the other guy's name?
DHS.
DHS. Yeah. Yeah. I follow his Twitter. So they just launched a company called once.com, which is basically you buy SaaS once, and they did the founder letter thing where it's, you know, what happened to the days when you buy software and you own it and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so they're trying to build like all, they're basically trying to clone every SaaS category one by one and launch them as like, you buy it, you own the code, and then you just like pop it up on a server. And there's all these people that are like really, you know, like, promoting this new idea for like the future of software. Like you just buy SaaS once and then you just put it on a server. I don't really fully get it because the whole reason I buy SaaS is because I don't want to maintain servers. So I was curious if you had like heard any of that or
as a SaaS CEO, I'll tell you my reaction to that, even though I don't know all the content. I don't think you only buy SaaS for the servers. I think you have SaaS, this is how I think about it. Maybe that's just because I'm an insider, is like you buy SaaS because you're paying for a development team to maintain the software. And hopefully if they're good, not just maintain it, but continue to deliver value to you.
Yeah. And security, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's like, and to be honest, it's like good SaaS, in my opinion, well pays for itself many times over. Like, you know, obviously if you're not using it, not getting value out of it, but you know, if it's core to your workflow, and you want that thing to keep developing and keep utilizing the latest, like, for example, like if we had just stopped building Grain, you know, a year and a half ago, there'd be no AI summaries. Now everyone loves AI summaries, and there's so much amazing stuff we're building right now because we know it's going to deliver value to our users and their workflows. And like, you know, I don't know. I didn't love the internet back in the day where you bought one piece of software and then it decayed. I don't think that was good internet. I'd rather.
Yeah. I mean, that's my exact opinion. And Chamath from the All In Pod, he's basically doing the same thing. He's copying it. He's copying the once.com model. And he has like this whole team where they're basically just cloning everything right now and just launching it on the one-time fee model. And I don't quite understand it. So I was curious if you had any thoughts.
I'm super biased, right? Because I'm a SaaS founder. So I would take what I was saying with a grain of salt, but it's like, I don't know. It's like, to me, it's like if you're building a business and this is critical software to do your best work, like I don't know why you would go on the cheap. Like maybe you'll say, like with Grain, for example, it's like, you know, our average customer is paying a couple grand a year. And I'm talking about for teams, right? Like teams of people. It's like, I think we deliver way more value than that in time and value and critical insights. And so it's like, you know, you could go buy some like oncegrain.com knockoff and it's going to a year later suck relative to Grain and you're going to miss out on all that. I don't know. It's just like, I'm a big believer in like just not being penny wise, pound foolish. It, to me, it just sounds like a penny wise, pound foolish, but like I'm not going to buy this, you know, this $30 audiobook because I don't want to spend $30, but there's $1 million idea in there and I'm not going to be benefit. I don't know. I just think in general, it's like, you get what you pay for, and I'd rather pay for a little bit more in the things that matter and get the upside. I don't know. That's my
two cents. Yeah, or worse, what if you just like throw it on a DigitalOcean droplet and then, you know, you don't maintain the server and then next thing you know, all your meetings get hacked and all your transcriptions are leaked out on.
Exactly. It's like we spend so much time and effort like on security, just making sure everything's super secure, constantly doing our security audits, reviews, like keeping our SOC 2. Like that's a lot of work. I wouldn't spend time on that if I was running a business. Like, why would you want to spend time on that across 50 different random apps that you have running on your own droplet? I don't know. It's just weird. I don't know.
Maybe yeah. I mean, that's exactly. Yeah. That's exactly.
I think probably if I'm going to steal man, what they're saying is like, I think they have a vision or at least, I don't know about the Jason Fried person, but I think I know Chamath's thought process a little better. It's like, he really believed in this vision of like two people and open AI building companies. I think that's his vision of the future. And I guess I could say if you think that's really going to be the future of software where like a couple people, like 2 to 3 people, maybe even one person and OpenAI is going to be building great businesses, then I could see a world where, you know, you don't have the money or because you're just bootstrapping these things. And so just buying 7 SaaSes that you need to build your business and hosting them all and AI can do all the security management. I mean, maybe that's the steal, man, is like, it's like, because you in the early days, you're going to need to be super frugal because you're just going to totally bootstrap all these things. I don't know.
So I definitely am like super pro AI. I think it's going to change a lot of things. I heard the best argument for why AI is not going to take everyone's jobs and destroy the whole world, like destroy the economy and all this stuff. I heard the best argument for that the other day. And basically it comes from someone who, you know, like Accenture consultant, worked on like big Fortune 500 implementations, worked on like multi 9-figure implementations of SAP. And basically they said like, companies can't even implement an ERP properly half the time. And it costs like hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, how are they going to implement AI across their whole company and like automate everything? You know, they can't even get like basic software working properly.
Yeah, I guess unless you believe the AI is going to, I don't know. I'm very much optimistic about AI, but I think there's a lot of hype and we'll see, you know, maybe I guess Elon Musk just said, by the end of next year, there'll be AI smarter than all humans on Earth or whatever. Maybe, I don't know. It depends on how you define intelligence and agency and all that stuff. And that gets deeply philosophical quickly. But I'll say as someone who works really closely with this as part of the business, like it's, again, I know this is natural. Humans are very adaptive and we sort of, you know, we like, oh, it's magic. And then you get used to it and then you kind of like find the flaws. But I will say like AI is a little more brittle and frustrating than I thought it was when it first came out. Like there's incredibly limited in surprising ways.
Yeah, definitely agree there. Did Elon say at the end of that statement that we'll also be living on Mars and the Cybertruck will be in full production by that point?
Said that. I mean, I think he also said, "I'm the best SaaS." No, I'm the best social media CEO in the world too. I'm not a hater on Elon. He's done some great stuff, but I also don't think, I don't know. Some people like think everything he says is like super insightful and thought out. And I think he just said provocative things personally. And like, he's clearly proven he doesn't know what the heck he's doing when he's running Twitter, but. Again, maybe some people are, that's polarizing talk, I guess, but.
I heard the other day someone said, this guy runs like 5 of the largest companies in the world and also still has time to troll on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like how, what's his time management look like?
I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. Again, like I said, I love Tesla. I love SpaceX. I think there's some great, he's done amazing work, but have not been a fan of the Twitter so far. Like, I just feel like it's just being taken over by spam and bots. But I don't know. Maybe that's my experience and not others.
Yeah. It's, you know, hit or miss, but cool. So let's go into the future of Grain. So what's like, as much as you can share, like what's on like the roadmap? Like, where do you want to take this company? Are you in it for the long haul? Like what do you see, you know, kind of coming in the years ahead?
Years, with how fast the tech is moving, is hard to, I'll kind of caveat or you what I just said a little bit. Like, you know, AI is moving fast and the tech is moving fast. And so it's hard for me to prognosticate for years ahead, but I will say, we're committed to the mission of making meetings, and particularly like the data inside the meetings, continually more useful and accessible. And we're going to stick to that, and in order to help people do better at their jobs and do their best work. On the short term, however, I think we're going to continually try and essentially, like, have you used the Grain's like custom templates yet?
No, I haven't. What's that?
So basically, like, we have our basic AI notes, which is just kind of summary, next steps, key points. But in Grain, you can use different templates, which are like different formats for your AI notes, and there's different ways of extracting data from your meeting. And so we've built kind of some out of the box templates, but also some of.
How do you get to that? I'm in the app right now.
Just off the meeting page, if you just go, there's like a little thing that says templates on the note. If you see notes. It'll be much more visible in our release you're going to see in 2 days. But just where it says, do you see where it says template basic meeting?
Yeah, let me just share the screen for people watching on YouTube here. So
So just open a meeting, one that maybe isn't sensitive. Yeah, so you see where it says on the top left, template basic meeting? Just below, go down just a little bit. It's just right below.
Oh, there. Yeah. Okay.
So you can see there's different meeting note formats for different types of meetings.
Okay.
And then if you click edit templates, you can see how you can kind of create your own by clicking create template up at the top right.
Nice.
And anyway, we don't need to go into all this right now on the pod, but basically what allows you to do is kind of create the notes in the format you'd like. So we're going to keep pushing on this idea of, like, we, you know, there's just kind of like basic AI summaries are great, but we can even do a lot better, recognizing that different meeting types have different information structure and essentially automating the process of getting the right information structure for the meeting that matches the meeting type and pushing that into different workflows. So that's kind of one of the next big kind of themes we're working on. We're also
it's more like a system level prompt for the AI when it's generating the meeting notes. Like, it kind of prescribes like what the purpose of the meeting notes are.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, if you're running a sales meeting, you know, a lot of sales people have very structured discovery calls. Like, so you might use Bant or Medic or whatever, where it's like, what's their budget? What's their authority? What's their need? What's their timeline? And you just extract that information. And so now that information, it's in the notes, but it also can now be used to update your CRM.
Wow. So you can just map it right into the deal in the CRM.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be a sales example, but there's other types of examples for like product management. If you're doing like a customer check-in, you might have a section called like, you know, product pain points, and you can map those directly to a product board or whatever it might be. And so that's the idea, is like extracting the right type of information for each meeting type and then kind of automating workflows around that. So that's one. Two is, and this will be a little bit less relevant for the non-sales folks, but we're doing a lot of work around deal insights and deal management inside of Grain. So that'll be something that's going to be really beneficial to our people who use us, who are sales oriented or customer success oriented. So the ability to kind of use the content of the calls themselves to sort of help you get a very quick understanding of the overall, you know, status and risks and opportunities of deals. And then we're going to keep just pushing on. There's just a very, very, very long tail of usability. We're about to ship trimming, which people have been asking for forever.
To trim the videos,
video editing and video trimming. So there's just still like a lot of kind of like core video engagement interactions experiences that we're going to keep pushing on.
So how do you, I always love this, how different SaaS founders answer this question. So how do you decide what features to focus on? And how does that differ from the early days of the company when you're still like figuring out the product market fit versus as you reach more maturity?
Yeah. So the way I think about it is at a high level, well, first of all, there's a strategy. And the strategy is essentially, in my opinion, it's defining where are you playing in the market and what's your theory on how you're going to capture the opportunity or win. That strategy should inform all your decisions. Then, so that's kind of at the macro level. And we could talk more about strategy if you want, how I think about it. Then you have, at the micro level, I have some kind of like broad-based heuristics that kind of, we don't perfectly follow, but they give you rough guidelines. So at this stage in Grain, we spend about 80-20 or 75-25 off, we call offense and defense. Offense are features that we feel are like moving the product forward and going to help us get new business, either by selling new people, getting more people to convert, maybe getting more people to upgrade. So it's like going to build the business and make it go forward.
Is an offense feature like a new feature in the market that nobody else has?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll come to that. But basically just think about offense. The way we think about it is like, it's going to get us new revenue, new business, essentially. And then defense is things that's going to help you hold on to your existing revenue. So that's one kind of simple heuristic is like because I think what happens to a lot of established products is they just build all defense. It's all about just like, how do we keep our existing revenue? They're not taking big new bets to kind of expand their market or entice new users over to their platform and stuff like that. I still think defense is very important. And that's like trimming, for example, would be a defensive feature. Like, I don't think it's going to help us convert anybody additionally that we wouldn't otherwise convert, or it's not going to make anyone pick our product or our competitors. But it is something that our existing user base really wants, and that we want to continue to make that product better for them and like solve their pain points. So that's one kind of layer of kind of feature framework heuristics. The other way I think about it too is the other framework I use a lot is I think about basically you have minimum market requirements, which is like for the segments that you're building for, there's like some set of features that are like must-haves. Like they're just the minimum requirements for your market. Like every competitor has them or will have them. And like, no, they're not even going to consider your tool if you don't have them. Then you have differentiators, which are things that you're building that are unique and different in areas where you're pushing out in other areas you don't think your competitors are pushing out. And then you have neutralizers, which are things that are like your competitor did it and you're worried that because they did it, they're going to start stealing some of your customers. And so you want to just build it to sort of like neutralize that competitive threat. So between those two frameworks, that's how we think about a lot. And we try to bias heavily 80-20 or 75-25 offense, defense. Within offense, we try to focus mostly on differentiators, but you know, obviously MMRs are important in offense too. That's kind of how we think about it. And then the other thing is I always step back, you know, even after all the framework stuff, I always like to also just step back and be like, what's the narrative? What's the narrative we're trying to tell over the next quarter about what our product can do and how we're going to talk about it? So that's kind of the different lenses I use.
And there's like a million, you know, sales frameworks and SaaS development frameworks and, you know, business frameworks and KPI frameworks. There's like, you know, endless books and endless things out there to follow. How much do you prescribe to the frameworks that you use versus just like intuition and gut feeling?
I do both. I think it's really important to... That's where the narrative comes in, gut feeling, where it's like, you know, I think it's important to think analytically about like, why would I build this feature? What's the thesis for it? Like I said, like, let me take a step back. I think intuition is good, but the problem with intuition is like, it's so easy to just listen to your customers and it's awesome. Everyone says, listen to your customers, and again, you should listen. I talk to my customer all the time. I constantly try to get inside their head, understand what's important to them. But the thing is you have to recognize that you're being biased constantly by your existing user base, which may or may not be a fit where you're trying to go. They have a limited perspective because they don't know like your vision of where you're trying to drive things. And so intuition is so easy just to be like, oh, we really need to just do these seven features because these are the seven most recent feature requests I heard or whatever. And so that's why I think the heuristics from frameworks can be really helpful to just gut check yourself and be like, we've decided that we're still at the stage of our business where we need to push forward aggressively and make new bets. You know, am I roughly aligned with my balance? So I typically will gut check my intuition against frameworks, but then I also gut check my frameworks against a broader back of what's the story we want to tell our users? If I'm going to do a launch in a quarter from now where we kind of take all the work together and tell a story, is it coherent? Or is I just built a bunch of random features that, or is there a coherent narrative of I didn't do the best job of it, but this whole narrative of that I was trying to tell about, we want to make it so that your notes match your meeting type and then they power workflows. That's a clean narrative, right?
I immediately clicked for me when you were describing that. And I was just thinking about all the automation that you could do with that, from having a meeting, pulling data in. I think the one thing that would need to be figured out is how to, human in the loop with the data to make sure that the right data is being ported. But that is a really awesome feature idea. I can't wait for that one.
Cool. Thank you.
So, yeah, man, this was an awesome pod. Is there anything else? We covered so much cool stuff here, but is there anything else you want to close out on? Obviously, promotion for Grain, but anything else you want to wrap here?
Yeah, I think that I'd just say, we talked a lot about you going back to this question of should I raise or should I not raise? I think the thing that I would say is a more foundational question is should I do a startup or not? So I don't know if that's interesting to your audience or not, but I have a lot of startup friends and we always talk about is this the right journey to go on? Because it's awesome. We've learned a lot. It's cool. I love the journey. There's also a lot of costs, right? It's you work probably a bit more than you would if you had kind of a more 9-to-5 tech job or whatever. You have a lot of opportunity costs and salary, especially early on. I think it's a tough decision, but I'd say I'm really glad I did it. And I think my general I don't think there's one answer, obviously, but I think that I think the worst reason to do a startup is to just because you think it's what all the cool kids are doing or what you should do. I think it's overly glamorized, but at the same time, the personal growth and learning that come through it is sort of maybe underappreciated. So I think at the end of the day, the worst reason to do it is just because you feel like that's what you need to do. Actually, the worst is because you're going to get rich. I don't think it's probably, money is the worst because I think there's probably better ways to make money. The second is just because you feel like that's the cool thing to do and I want the social. But the reasons why you should do it is there's something that you just want to build, you're so passionate about building it and you're I need to build this or I need to solve this problem and no one's solving it. That is a fantastic way to do it. And it's going to, that passion for whatever you're building is going to drive you through all the ups and downs. The second is if you're I want to go on a journey that I'm just going to learn, it's going to be super painful, but it's going to stretch me in some really uncomfortable ways that help me grow. Anyway, that's my quick.
I completely agree with you. I think, the startup influencers, the Noah Kagan's and the, was a 4-hour work week, Tim Ferriss, those influencers glamorized it and made it seem you just work a little bit and then you just, go live in Latin America or, Italy or something and just sit on your laptop on the beach and do some emails and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not what it's to build and run companies. And I think that's why so many people fail just because they have the wrong expectations going in. It's taxing mentally, emotionally, physically
and it's longer than you probably think, honestly. Again, I'm speaking to broad brushstrokes, maybe you'll get lucky and but I think we have a lot of accretion of narratives and they're not culturally, especially in tech, and they don't get updated as much. It's in the early days of the web, you probably could just throw out an app. It was the first one of its kind, it hit it off and you maybe could get a quick exit in a few years. I don't see that happening in my cohort. I started my entrepreneurial journey in 2016, 2017. And I have a lot of friends about that same vintage of entrepreneurs that started around that time. And I would say there's nobody in that vintage that's building a good company that has exited yet, completely exited. They might emerge and kind of doing something like I'm doing where they're kind of continuing the journey on or whatever. But it just takes a long time. It just takes a long time to build a good company that where you're going to see value out of. Again, like I said, there it can happen, but it's just probably not going to be the case.
Yeah, 100%. And I totally agree with your point about you know, you mentioned that like you have to want to build. And I even take that a step further and say you have to be obsessed with building. Like you have to just
love that.
You have to just be like obsessed with wanting to build things and just make them great and just constantly refine and improve and iterate. And that's like, I think the key quality, that with like perseverance, I think are the two key qualities for it. But yeah, this was an awesome pod, man. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it was super fun to connect and chat about things.
Did you clear your cash flow?